Oh, that's beautiful. Now, a predator looking for a language animal. But it's not just one language you found, because the language in God of Small Things, the language in A Ministry of Utmost Happiness, and the language in Mother Mary comes to me. Would you say, I mean, you can see something, but it's not uniform?
Yes, it's, you know, everything for me, everything I choose to write, whether it was the God of Small Things or whether it's every single political essay or whether walking with the comrades or whether it was the essay on the dams or Mother Mary comes to me. The first thing is to search for the language. You know, the first thing is to search for the language, the structure, and how do I create this universe? You know, so that's my enterprise when I write, you know.
Talk about the difference between writing fiction and nonfiction. You had gotten away from fiction for a while. You were deeply involved in politics in Kashmir. And what it means to be an activist and to speak out in India. And then we want to take it to what it means to come here, to go from Modi land to Trump land.
Well, you know, honestly, Amy, there is a part in this book where I make little jokes about the fact that people call me an activist, because I say, this is what writers do. You know, this is what writers have done through the ages. But now we are being domesticated and made to live on bestseller lists and literature festivals, and therefore a writer that writes politically or writes about what's going on in her world isn't a writer but a writer activist, you know? But to me, that reduces the scope and the power of literature, you know? So for me, as I said, you know, everything that I do has to do with what is the most effective way of communicating what I want to communicate. Like, is it an essay? Is it a book of fiction? Nothing is less political than the other thing. And you know, people often pit my nonfiction against my fiction. And this, my most beloved writer, John Berger, who wrote Ways of Seeing, of course, famously, which all of us grew up on. I didn't know him, and I saw this fax coming through. In those days, the fax machine. And he said, your fiction and your nonfiction, they walk you through the world like your two legs, you know. And I loved him for understanding that. To me, they were separate artistic enterprises, but they were not separate political enterprises. They were not separate silos. And I just, you know, for me, it was always just searching. And cinema, I mean, before that, I was working in film and architecture too, you know. All these things, they're not separate for me. They are like layers and layers, which make me this sedimentary rock, you know.
Just to go back to this book more specifically, you said, you know, that this is, that it may have been the question of whether it was a betrayal of your younger self or not. In part, it's informed by the fact that you were able to write this book because you did not, though there was a risk, end up on drugs or broken, etc., after you left home when you were so young. That certainly didn't happen. But you do have a certain, the impact of this childhood on your intimate relationships, as you recount them. You mentioned this in passing right now, that one of the lessons you learned, and you say it a couple of times in the book, one of the lessons you learned as a child was that the safest place can be the most dangerous. And as an adult, even when the safest place was the safest, you experienced it as dangerous or made it so.
Yeah, that's a very hard thing to cope with and deal with, because that was true for me. The safest place was the most dangerous, and then you just don't trust safety. Even when it's offered to you, you don't trust it, you know? And I had, obviously, apart from everything else, there was massive financial insecurity, and I spent a great deal of my youth just thinking about money. I had no ambitions. I just was like, how am I getting through this week, or how am I getting through the next week? And then you know, and then came a stage when I wrote The God of Small Things and I had more money than I wanted or needed. And then I thought about money just the same amount, but in a different way. Like, how do you share it? How do you deploy it politically and all of this? And I naturally gravitate towards the unsafe. You know, someone asked me, you know, how do you keep this conversation going with your childhood? And I said it's because I was a very adult child, and maybe there's something childish about me as an adult, but that communication is always open, and you always got your eye on those who are unsafe, you know. And so there's one part of me that I suppose moves towards trying to make it less bad for them, or trying to use, especially, you know, the money that comes from being a writer whose books sell a lot to help others do the work they really want to do, which nobody would fund, or, you know, which are not sort of NGOized and foundationized and corporatized and, you know, sort of what we call paltusher, like making people into a tiger on a leash, pretend dangerous, you know. But
so speaking of danger, although it's not exactly in the same context, talk about what it has been like to write, to speak out, to be politically involved, as you've been for decades, under Narendra Modi. What is happening in India right now? The crackdown on dissent. And then we'll talk about your views and observations about the United States.
Well, let's say that what is happening in the United States today happened to us in 2014. You know, and often say the attempted coup of January 6th over here succeeded in India, and the people in antlers and furs actually rule us, you know. It is so, and today the problem is that it's not just the regime, but that poison has actually seeped down into the population. And so you have a situation where people are policing people are lynching people. Thousands of people can come out on the street with swords and call for the rape or the death of Muslims. And it's all getting normalized, you know. You watch lynching and it's uploaded on YouTube. And people who actually speak up are in jail. There's a lot of that in this book. You know, a friend of mine who was put into prison for 10 years and then acquitted. He was almost completely paralyzed when he went in, a professor of literature, acquitted, saying that he should not have spent one day in prison. But 10 years he spent, came out, and 6 months later he was dead because his body just had lost its resilience, you know. So we're in a nightmare that now is just normalized, and nobody even thinks of it as much of a nightmare, which is the most dangerous thing. You know, you have, if you have protests in the United States by the so many people who are disturbed about Gaza, the police, you know, end it. But in India, once a friend of Palestine, there have been no protests, and there are, you know, 200 people show up. The police don't stop it. The Hindu right wing comes out and stops it. You know, so how do you unpoison this river is the question.
And explain Narendra Modi's relationship with this Hindu right.
So he belonged to an organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, which is now going to celebrate its 100th year this year. It is an organization that believed that India should be declared a Hindu nation and Hindus should be its first citizens. And the political party that Modi is the head of, BJP, it's just the front desk of the RSS, which has worked very, very hard, I have to say, in education, in culture, in agriculture. It has organizations, it has hundreds of thousands of volunteers, they call themselves, you know. And it has penetrated every institution in India. And so when I say the same thing happened to us in 2014, it's so unnerving because you think, Do they have a real physical playbook, or is it just how this kind of fascism works? You know, the attack on universities, the attack on intellectuals, the attack on citizenship, the attack on the economy, the changing of history, the reversing of any kind of moves on social justice. You know, it's so similar, except that in India, it's first of all much more organized because it's a 100-year-old organization. And second of all, although I know that, you know, Democracy Now! And so many other non-mainstream channels rage against the American mainstream, it's nothing compared to what the media in India has done. You know, the media in India has been criminal. I mean, seriously, they should be tried in front of a war tribunal for the violence that they have endorsed, for the poison they have intravenously dripped into people, for the TV anchors behaving like captains of lynch mobs, for the fake news, for the absolutely unforgivable decades of support where, you know, corporate news channels, So the fascism is completely underwritten by Indian corporations and has been, because they own all the media. You know, they own, like, some of them own 20 channels, 24-hour news channels, you know.
You mentioned, and this is actually one of the most, at least on the global stage, one of the most dramatic reversals in India's policy, which is no longer backing Palestine, which goes against, I mean, decades of India's position. So let's just talk about, in fact, what's happening in Palestine today, which you have also spoken out about and been deeply critical about Israel's war on Gaza, deemed now by most international legal and human rights organizations to be genocide. So if you could, I don't know, just respond to what's happening in Gaza and the response, the split, what appears to be a split among most countries in the global south, that is the global south in, on one side, and the global north, although now it seems there are at least some countries shifting their position.
Look at the psychology that is being forced upon us. We are, all of us, able to reach at night for an image of a child starving or a person being blown up in Gaza easier than reaching for a glass of water. And we are helpless. We are able to do nothing more than keep speaking about it. And I've come to a stage where I feel humiliated to have to discuss it, because what is there to discuss? What is there to discuss when you're murdering children, destroying hospitals, destroying universities, murdering journalists, and boasting about it, boasting about it? And everybody's sort of ambiguous. I mean, what we are witnessing also is, I think there are surveys that say that almost 90% of the population of the world wants this to stop. But there is no connection between democratically elected governments and the will of the people. It's ended. So the whole charade of Western liberal democracy is as much of a corpse under the rubble as the tens of thousands of Palestinians.
The trajectory you see, I remember you standing in the iconic church, Riverside Church, giving your speech against President George W. Bush invading Iraq and what that means in the level of global revulsion, the mass protest of millions, and yet still it happened. And where you see us today and whether you hold out any hope.
One of the books that you mentioned of mine, Azadi, it has been banned by the Indian government, and we are in this process of living through a time when everyone thinks we have free speech, but we are actually being policed in such crazy ways. You know, the internet is switched off by any government whenever they want to, and so on.
Wasn't it just recently banned?
Yes.
Azadi, Fascism, Fiction, and Freedom in the Time of the Virus.
Yes. But But you see, one of my books of essays has been dedicated to those who have learned to divorce reason from hope. And we have to hope. We have to be unreasonable, and we have to hope, and we have to do what we have to do. You know, I don't want to sound like some cute, you know, person saying, oh, everything will be all right. But at the same time, I mean, the end of my talk about Allah Abdul Fattah in London a few months ago was that it can't continue like this. I mean, Israel, yes, it has devastated Gaza, but it has devastated itself too. It is reviled in the eyes of the world for what it has done, you know. And it has also, I'm sure that all the young people that committed those horrible crimes, one day it will destroy them.
Arundhati Roy, author of her new memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. Coming up in this holiday special, we remember Bill Moyers, the legendary PBS broadcaster and former White House aide who died in June at the age of 91. Now, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end this holiday special remembering the legendary journalist Bill Moyers, who died in June at the age of 91. In the 1960s, he was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps, served as press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. In 1971, Moyers began an award-winning career as a TV broadcaster that would last over 40 years. During that time, Bill Moyers received over 30 Emmys, countless other prizes, many for his programs on PBS, also a longtime champion of public television and independent media, his death coming while the Trump administration was stripping federal funding from PBS and NPR. In 2011, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Bill Moyers. He outlined his critique of the corporate media.
The consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today. They wouldn't see it this way, and there are exceptions, but the corruption of corporate media, corporate power, and government is what makes so vital what the two of you do. I'm serious about that. You don't have the scope of Meet the Press. I mean, look at Meet the Press. Who's been on Meet the Press more than any other figure in Washington in the last several years? Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, I later learned when I was briefly at NBC as an analyst doing commentaries, controversial commentaries, actually came to the brass of NBC and GE. Newt Gingrich has had some nefarious relationship with General Electric, which is one of the huge government contractors, as well as the owner of Meet the Press. And it's just an example of what I'm talking about, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media with power, corporate power, government power, with exceptions, I repeat, is something that without the antidote of independent reporting and analysis that you do and others, we would be in we would be in a dark, dark pit with no light shining on us.
I want to go back, since we're talking about broadcasting, right back to the Johnson era and then jump back to here, which is about the founding of public broadcasting and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, especially for young people, to understand why it began and where it's gone.
Well, there were three—believe it or not, I mean, nobody below 40 will believe this. You may not believe it, because both of you are much younger than I am. But when I was 20 years old, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And ABC was only half a network, no news division, all of that. And so we were dependent upon three corporate, advertising-driven, commercial networks for our information. And to his credit, Lyndon Johnson, who made his fortune, part of his fortune, by controlling the three. He had one station in Austin that had a monopoly over broadcasting the product, the content of all three networks. I mean, that's how he made his money, much of his money. But he really did believe. He was a teacher. He had taught poor Mexican students in the little town of Cotulla, Texas. He was a populist from a poor part of
South Texas.
Yeah, but he went to South Texas. He came from Central Texas, went to South Texas to teach in this Mexican school. And he really cared about poor, and he cared about education. He felt there should be one channel that was free of commercials and free of commercial values, because he knew what commercial values will do to people who are reporting the news, producing content. The desire to amuse and entertain will cause us to compromise the truth. So when the Carnegie Corporation and the Carnegie Commission, John Gardner had been head of the Carnegie Corporation, and they did a study of what to do about educational television in this country. The report was actually delivered to my desk when I was still at the White House. The Carnegie Commission became the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And I wish we had it here, because the speech Lyndon Johnson made when he signed the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 is a great tribute to a network devoted to the life of the mind, the life of the spirit, and the diversity of American voices. He believed that only white, male, straight guys got on national television in those days, and he was right. And he saw the value, the changes coming in America, and he believed there should be a public media that was devoted to the diversity, the pluralism of American life, and to the highest expression of the creative and journalistic arts.
And the actual act of the creating the Corporation for Public Television talked about serving underserved communities of America.
And unfortunately, as you probably noticed, that there was a report done by Fairness and Accuracy in Media, a public interest group. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting,
Fair.
And they show that even on public broadcasting today, in our mainstream broadcast, it's usually the official view of reality that's represented. Far more corporate spokesmen than labor or working people spokesmen. Far more white male figures of authority than people of color and marginalized people. That's just a tendency of human beings that always has to be resisted. And public television, public radio belongs to the people. Go back and read a great document, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And when we stray from it, as we sometimes do, the public has to rise up and say, we own you, we are your shareholders, come back to first principles, come back to first things.
So what has happened to public broadcasting right now, the onslaught? You talk about, you just wrote a piece about NPR and PBS, and you talk about, well, Nixon first tried to gut it and then take it forward.
Richard Nixon tried to—he did succeed in fragmenting our authority, because he didn't like—I was on the air, Robert McNeil was on the air, we were doing journalist work, but he called us liberals because we were trying to get at the facts. He and Pat Buchanan, his communications director, succeeded in harming, injuring public broadcasting back in the 1970s. Thanks to a great Republican who was chairman of the public television station in Dallas, we beat him off. They wanted to defund us completely, but they didn't. Then Newt Gingrich comes along, Robert Dole comes along with the right wing in the late 80s, and he tries to defund public broadcasting. Then comes Newt Gingrich in 1994, and now we had George W. Bush and his team who came after some of us on public broadcasting. Conservatives, on principle, don't believe that federal funds should be used to support the media. But then also they don't believe in allowing any alternative voices, any alternatives to the official view of reality to be heard. So they have always been against public broadcasting. And sometimes a self-censorship occurs because you're looking over your shoulder and you think, well, if I do this story or that story, it'll hurt public broadcasting. Public broadcasting has suffered often for my sins. Reporting stories, the officials don't want reported. And today, only about a very small percentage of funding for NPR and PBS comes from the government, but that accounts for a concentration of pressure and self-censorship. And only when we get a trust fund, only when the public figures out how to support us independently of the federal treasury, will we flourish as an independent media.
Are you hopeful these days, despite the what we've discussed about the state of the media? We've obviously seen these enormous uprisings throughout the Arab world. On Democracy Now, we've covered the democratic popular renaissance that's occurred throughout all of Latin America in recent years, that there are parts of the world where things are hopeful. But right here at home in the United States, things don't always seem like they're heading in a good direction.
I think this country is in a very precarious state at the moment. I think, as I say, the escalating, accumulating power of organized wealth is snuffing out everything public, whether it's public broadcasting, public schools, public unions, public parks, public highways. Everything public has been under assault since the late 1970s, the early years of the Reagan administration, because there is a philosophy that's been extant in America for a long time that anything public is less desirable than the public than private. So I think we're at a very critical moment in the equilibrium. No society, no human being can survive without balance, without equilibrium. Nothing in excess, the ancient Greeks said. And Madison, one of the great framers of our Constitution, built equilibrium into our system. We don't have equilibrium now. The power of money trumps the power of democracy today, and I'm very worried about it. I said to her, and if we don't address this, if we don't get a handle on what we were talking about, money in politics, and find a way to thwart it, tame it, we're in trouble. Democracy should be a break on unbridled greed and power, because capital, like a fire, can turn from a servant, a good servant, into an evil master. And democracy is the break on my passions and my appetites and your greed and your wealth. And we have to get that equilibrium back. I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street, how do you feel about the market? He said, well, I'm optimistic. And I said, why do you then look so worried? And he said, because I'm not sure my optimism is justified. And I feel that way. So I fall back on the balance wheel in the Italian political scientist Gramsci, who said that he practices the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. By that he meant he sees the world as it is, without rose-colored glasses, as I try to do as a journalist. I see what's there. That will make you pessimistic. But then you have to exercise your will optimistically, believing that each of us singly and all of us collectively can be an agent of change. And I have to get up every morning and imagine a more confident future and then try to do something that day to help bring it about.
The legendary Bill Moyers in 2011. He died in June at the age of 91. To see all our interviews with him, you can go to democracynow.org. And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, find us on social media, and please support our vital work through our website. CJ.